Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A snag in the deal, then unsnagged. Safe havens pull markets to a new high. Bond yields drop as the dovish views persist. And our guest today is ESG analyst Robbie Miles from Allianz Global Investors. All this and much more on episode number 637 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a very good day to you all, hoping you're keeping warm as we have this cold snap that is hitting all of us. I mean, even down here in Florida, it got down to, you know, all right, I'm not complaining that it got down to the mid-50s because a lot of people around the country are obviously getting hit a lot harder. But the bottom line is that we are seeing the beginning of winter. So here we are back in that time of year again where it's going to be a little bit colder, a little bit cloudier, a little bit grayer. The daytime is a little bit more compressed. Nighttime comes a little bit earlier. I'm Andrew Horowitz, host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast and founder of Horowitz & Company. We're an investment advisory firm, and I've been doing this for the better part, I guess, right now of more than 25 years. It's been unbelievable what I've seen throughout that time, you know, from incredible rallies with the tech bubble, major crashes when it went pop. Once again, we've seen, you know, right up into the housing crash. And I mean, it's been interesting times, if nothing else. And all that time, what we've been doing is helping people like you with their investments and financial planning. And if you want more information about what we can do to help you, just head on over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. See all the different things that we do, the strategies that we manage, and maybe something's there for you. Check it out. Well, it seems like there's some confusion about where we are with regard to this trade deal. We saw that last week there was some commentary from China saying, hey, you know what? Good news. Looks like there's going to be some rollbacks of some of the tariffs with this phase one skinny partial deal that's going on. Everybody was kind of excited about that, you know, it looks like both sides are really getting along. And wow, that's good. That was kind of the beginning of how this week all started. And that, in fact, was further certified or agreed upon in substance from comments that we heard from the U.S. side as well. So therefore, hey, you know what? Things look like they're getting a little bit better. That was great. Then it seems that President Trump came out and said, no, you know what? No, not really. That's not really the case. I haven't decided on any rollbacks. I don't think I'm going to be rolling back stuff. As a matter of fact, if China doesn't get this thing done, even though they want a deal done more than we do, maybe there's going to be further tariffs that are going to be put on, the December 15th tariffs that are scheduled to go on for a lot of goods related to personal electronics and some retail, things that would really be, I guess, those products that would be bought heavily for the holiday season. And President Trump said, no, we don't have any, we have no thoughts of changing what we're doing. We're making sure this deal gets done. And this was actually right at the beginning, and then we started getting into some of the articles that we saw that said, well, there's now a snag. Yep, there's some problems. We saw headlines come out that said there was some roadblocks in the process, that China isn't happy about the amount of agricultural buys that they want to have and to make this deal happen. They also were not in agreement about some of the enforcement mechanisms. So we kind of went back and forth throughout the week. A headline, it takes the market down a bit, but then everybody's like, well, this thing's going to get done, so let's just buy it up again and buy that dip. And we have a lot of momentum in this market right now. So what the heck? You know, we have a very dovish Fed, and we have, a deal that looks like it's going to happen. We have seasonality that looks pretty good towards the end of the year going into November. Of course, the potential for a Santa rally. And that threw markets around a bit because it was getting I would say, conflicting discussions. And then all of a sudden, Thursday night, Larry Kudlow comes out and he says, hey, you know what? A deal's really close. I mean, a deal is really close. And just like he does pretty much every week, especially on Fridays, he comes out almost on schedule on a Friday saying, hey, you know, things looking good. The U.S. economy is in good shape. And, you know, the stock market's doing really well. And it looks like this China deal is going to happen pretty soon. We have a lot of high confidence. And that was really taken well by markets. And boom, they all went up. And this looks like a pattern. It's starting to look like a pattern, at least. And it looks like a pattern that's designed to keep markets interested. I don't know if that's saying anything, if it's good or if it's bad. It doesn't matter. It is what it is. It's a process that's happening where the administration is trying to make sure that people think that there's a good deal, a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, that this deal is going to get done. Once it gets done, the stock market's going to do well. I mean, all these things that are obvious to what we know at this point. We just want some kind of conclusion, at least, even if this deal isn't great. All right, put that aside for a second. This week, what I want to do is get into a discussion about the idea of something called ESG analysis and ESG investing. ESG, environmental, social, and governance. You're going to be hearing a lot more about this, and I started seeing a lot more about this and did some research into it, and I said, you know what? We really got to get somebody that has an expertise in this area on the show to explore the topic. So, you know, I got somebody who's an expert, and let's get into the discussion with him right now and see what he has to say. And as I mentioned, our guest today is Robbie Miles. He's a CFA, and he is an ESG analyst with Allianz Global Investors, which he joined it back in 2014. In 2017, he moved to San Fran from, overseas to facilitate the integration of ESG in the U.S., and he has an analytical responsibilities on the ESG research team for the tech, utilities, and industrial sectors with a particular focus on clean technologies. So this is going to be interesting because we really haven't talked about this much, this whole idea of ESG. We're going to get into it. Robbie, how are you?
Really good. Thank you, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. You know, it's interesting because recently I was introduced to, I've heard the word, or the letters, the concept of ESG for a while now. And what's interesting is that attended a luncheon, got a lot of information about it and a meeting. And all of a sudden now, all I see everywhere is ESG. You know, it's kind of like when you buy a white car and all you see is white cars everywhere. Yeah, yes. I don't know. But I thought I would bring you on because you're an expert in this area. But let's just start with the very basics. Let's get with a discussion of what exactly is ESG research and the whole concept of looking at ESG from an investment standpoint?
Great. Well, first of all, I've been listening to your podcast and I'm enjoying it a lot.
Oh, thanks.
I'm really happy to be here. ESG stands for environment, social, and governance. And really, these are the three pillars of sustainability. We need to live on a planet that can sustain life and civilization. Society needs to be healthy, well balanced in terms of socioeconomic capabilities to rise the ladder and keep the capital markets healthy. And then governance is really the idea that people can do bad things if given the opportunity, but governance structures can minimize the opportunity for those people to act badly through incentivizing people in the right way and having the checks and balances in place.
So let's just start with the E for a second. Let's go to environmental. Well, let me back up. But before I do that, why is this important though now? Whereas, let's for a moment say this is a new area, relatively new, right? I mean, there's been the whole idea of, okay, what's this company's carbon footprint and what are they doing environmentally? But why is this becoming important right now?
Well, when you hear companies talk about sustainable cash flow, sustainable earnings, you know, investors like to ask, is the dividend sustainable? What we're really wondering is in a perpetual time horizon, is the company going to continue being able to return money back to shareholders? And we have always had a fairly narrow view of what sustainability is in that context. And it's always been the financial context. But really, as I've just mentioned, there are some wider aspects that are also material. You know, we can talk about climate change and how that might affect companies, but social issues like gender equality, you know, we found that through academic research that companies with two or more board directors who are female outperform and have better checks and balances in place to keep the CEO's ego in check. And
well, that assumes the CEO is a male. But I mean, was it get away from the whole idea of a big boys club? I kind of envision when you're saying this, the idea of just a smoke-filled boardroom with whiskey drinking guys yucking it up versus, you know, what you're, I don't know, somehow I got this image of cleaning that all up because there are other people looking in that may not be part of that crowd.
Exactly. But the real crucial word here is materiality. You know, what we're not trying to do is, be eco warriors and let our ethics and moral subjective opinions cloud our investment judgment. We're all aligned here, whether it be the company management, traditional shareholders, and ESG shareholders. We all want to maximize value over the long term, but the ESG insights are increasingly valuable because we are beginning to recognize that we have to think bigger about what is material. And, in the long run, I'd love to work myself out of a job. There shouldn't really be any difference between ESG and normal fundamental investing. And the lines are getting more and more blurred. Ideally, portfolio managers will just do this as part of their bread and butter.
I mean, I guess what you're saying is it's kind of like a plug-in that adds to the fundamental analysis versus just not even looking at this. In other words, if you have a situation where a company may be, okay, let's talk about a real situation. Potentially you have a company that is involved in the paper business. And we realize and recognize that all of a sudden we have this poor turtle who has a straw up his nose. And that may be just the poster child, if you will, the poster turtle for that matter, of what the bigger situation is with plastic islands and all the waste and all the things about plastic. And we have two things that are going on. We have this paper company that actually may be very environmentally friendly and it may be a beneficiary of this, but yet the plastics company, all of a sudden, in the realization of this, we have to start looking at the environmental and social impact for those two things, I would think. And that then would possibly change their ESG score to a point that may be a non-investable asset. That's an oversimplification.
No, that's a great example. So, you know, a paper company might actually be a beneficiary of the trend towards plastic straws being banned in many parts of the world because the paper straws are the alternative. But the plastic pollution is a massive problem. 40% of the plastic we make is for single-use plastic, and most of that ends up in landfill. It's very difficult to recycle plastic that's not clear, that's transparent. And most of this packaging is, it just ends up in landfill. We've all seen the pictures, as you mentioned, of straws in wildlife.
It's a big problem. So the whole the idea is to try to, as an ESG research analyst, or utilizing ESG as, again, I'm using as a plug-in into my fundamental analysis, essentially what you're saying is, again, in this example, we may be able to find out a little bit of the weaknesses or strengths of a company and utilize that in the other parts of our analysis to therefore give us a much better insight into the company and the potential for sustainability of their financials, right? I mean, that's kind of the whole point.
Yeah, can they reinvest in more sustainable practices, or is their entire business model anchored to this unsustainable practice, which now society is waking up to the negative consequences of, and therefore the share price is going to get hit? Or can they adapt and turn this disaster into an opportunity and, you know, evidence their recycling capabilities and prove to shareholders that they're not going to destroy value?
So that's interesting, because now you're getting into the governance part of this also, right? So we have, first of all, the E, which is the environmental, and we're talking about how there is the potential for a company to have a problem related to some event or some issue, and then whether or not the company itself and the management can make the changes willing to make the changes necessary to battle this issue, to change what they're doing, to reinvent themselves somehow, right? So if we have a company that deals in plastics and somehow, I don't know, there is this potential for a ban on their specific plastics. Let's take Monsanto as a great example. Monsanto has a business, a gigantic business. One of the things they have is Roundup. Roundup has been proven to cause cancer. Somehow, magically, the company is sold with this knowledge to Bayer. So now Bayer has an environmental problem, right?
Correct.
And now you have to figure out, okay, well, what is the extent of that? And more so, what is the management thereby going to do to take care of this? So you have a governance issue.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So now we have the E, the G also in terms of governance. Give me some examples of governance.
Right. So in this example, we would look at pay. Incentives create actions. And if the company's management is incentivized to maximize short-term profit at the expense of the long-term sustainability of the company, then we would deem that to be risky. But we do have the ability to vote at the annual general meeting. And many jurisdictions, like in the US, you have a say on pay. So this will get a shareholder vote every year. And if it doesn't get more than 50% approval, it's actually not legally binding, but it's really bad for the reputation of the company. That, you know, the company secretary does not want that signal from investors, and the compensation committee on the board would definitely respond to that if they knew that they themselves could be voted off the board by shareholders, which indeed they can be. So we have this ability to engage with companies, and in relation to Bayer, we would want to see that the CEO is incentivized to outperform the peers over a long-term horizon. You know, one of the major problems that we're seeing in the US at the moment is the issue of CEOs being paid in stock options. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, the benefits of stock options are that they do incentivize growing the value of the company, because if you don't, then the stock options don't vest. But there are many disadvantages, ways that they incentivize bad behavior. And buybacks are one such area.
Ugh, a pet peeve of mine.
Right. Because if a company buys back stock, that's a really nice way of ensuring that the CEO gets a nice, juicy couple of tens of million dollar payout for that year's performance. But that could be jeopardizing the long-term viability of the company. I mean, in fact, we actually saw Lehman Brothers buying back stock in the first 9 months of 2008. So it's clear that companies are not always making the best capital allocation decisions. And stock options are a really common way that the companies pay their CEOs.
Well, the problem you have with that is, as I see it, and what I've been complaining about, is this whole idea that, you know, you have, okay, what's good for the company? And everybody seems to view these days is, well, a company's doing good if their stock's going up. Well, okay, well, what's driving that stock higher? Is it actually earnings that are based on earnings growth? And how is that broken up? And is it good earnings, or is it quote unquote bad earnings? Is it earnings that are coming up from internally kind of growing their revenue stream and expanding their product line, cutting expenses to a degree to make themselves meaner and leaner? Or is it simply financial engineering? And I think that's what you're getting into here, is the idea of financial engineering in order to provide an increase in shareholder value, which is seen as a good thing, but how long can that last?
Right, especially if you're funding the share buybacks with debt, as is the case in roughly 50% of buybacks.
But this is kind of a new phenomenon, isn't it? This didn't happen 25 years ago to the degree it's happening today.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the number 25 years ago because you're right. But I mean, it's about 35 years ago. But there's a study saying that CEO pay has risen 940% since 1978, whilst worker pay has only increased 12%. And a lot of that is due to central bank policy. But what we're seeing is clearly CEOs are managing to find very clever ways of paying themselves more. And I think share buybacks are a big part of that. And yes, there has to be there's a place for share buybacks. Obviously, there's a tax on dividends, so it may be more efficient to buy back stock than pay dividends.
But what's happening is also they're also doing the share buybacks to prevent the dilution of the valuation when the CEO's management and those getting their options exercise those options. So it creates an automatic and immediate way for them to dispose of their security, right?
Yeah.
While keeping up the stock. I mean, there's a lot of shenanigans. Let's be honest.
It is, but this is what's so good about sustainable investing and the fact that it's really growing in popularity at the moment, because it puts more impetus on ESG teams to be really responsible stewards of companies. So, you know, just to give you an example, of the AGMs that we voted this year, we voted against 75% of CEO pay designs, and we only supported 25%. And that actually does, because it affects the ego of the executives, it actually does prompt positive change. And actually, it's actually linked to things like climate change, because if a CEO is paid to effectively expand the empire, like just grow revenues at any expense, then they will. And with oil and gas, many companies, especially the shale gas companies in the US, have just historically spent a lot of money growing the resource base under which the company controls, but it doesn't actually necessarily focus on the profitability of the extraction of those resources. So instead of focusing the pay to incentivize revenue growth, we'll look to make sure that the earnings per share or return on invested capital or relative total shareholder return are being incentivized for instead.
Now, this is what you're doing at Allianz through your mutual funds, through your investments and all that. Now, one of the other things that I know that you're doing is you're creating a proprietary, well, at least at this point, a proprietary ESG rating system, right? And one of the things is that I have a question of is this going to be standardized? Not yours necessarily, but is this going to be this concept of ESG ratings? Is it going to be standardized across the industry like we've seen some other kinds of these kinds of carbon footprint concepts being standardized? Is this going to be something that's going to be used by a lot of players, or do you think you're kind of well ahead and really going to be one of the few that uses this?
Well, we are well ahead for sure. We've been doing it for two decades, and the sustainable investing is more advanced in Europe. The market was there first, but I think it's going to be pretty disparate rather than homogenous, because really it's going to be as disparate as the fundamental views on stocks, because where investors perceive material risk to be will be different. So some investors will be saying that climate change mitigation is the biggest risk, i.e. the risk that courthouses, consumers, and governments work together to effectively increase the cost of fossil fuels, of carbon. But then there are other investors that say, we just don't see that being politically possible. And we think that human beings are more reactive, and our way of assessing the risks of climate change is looking at the adaptation risks. So we are maybe, looking at our REIT exposure in the Gulf of Mexico because of potential storm damage. So it's quite hard to say one size is going to fit all, and it also depends slightly on the time scale that you're looking at.
What about the concept of using ESG overlays on countries themselves? And let's take, you obviously do not have a San Fran accent. Seems like you're from over the pond in Brexit land. That's what it sounds like to me, right?
Brexit land, yeah.
Okay. And if we were to kind of utilize ESG in the area of governance, for example, well, this can go a long way for every country, but let's kind of focus on England for a second. I mean, they would probably have a pretty poor governance rating right now because of the uncertainties and all the problems with what's going on, whether it's Johnson or whether it was May or Corbyn or whoever you want to call is going to be involved in this whole process. Is there something that you do also from on a country or regional basis? Is that something that can be done?
Yeah, and this gets more into fixed income when you're buying sovereign debt. But our main focus at the moment is on equities. So we do look at countries' risk, but you know, a lot of the FTSE 100 companies have geographic exposure all over the world. Mm-hmm. So we look at the company's exposure holistically, and it's sort of more company specific rather than country specific, and the type of decisions that management are making that either increase or decrease the exposure to material risk. But certainly, as you're saying, like, yeah, the uncertainty will increase the governance risk in the UK because no one knows what's going on, and they haven't for 3 years, and that prevents capital investment, and there are knock-on effects. So yeah, you're totally right.
You know, if we had ESG ratings, the whole idea of environmental, social, and governance, and just taking those first two from your area, and we would have put that on specific products, like get it down deep into a particular, like we talked about Roundup, for example, right? That being an item, obviously governance wouldn't cover there, but you would have maybe the environmental, maybe the social, right? Where would you rate Marmite? Because I think it depends on which side of it on. I think from, and by the way, folks, if you haven't tried Marmite, go to the supermarket, grab one of those, get a little, what, a saltine maybe? Robbie, a little maybe a piece of toast?
Piece of toast,
right? Dry toast, and just get a little toast and put a very thin layer of this stuff on a piece of dry toast and eat it. Now, mind you, have either a cup of coffee, a gallon of water, or maybe a glass of whiskey.
Tea. Afraid it's got to be tea.
Yeah. So from your side, Marmite may be like, hey, what's about? From our side, we'd be like, Marmite is definitely a negative social impacting and a very bad environmentally issue, you know?
So, well, you know what? Marmite actually is a waste product. I think it's
clearly.
it's yeast that comes from the brewing process. So Marmite would score 10 out of 10 for environmental stuff.
Oh, for environmental, good point, because it's not being, I understand. Basically, just to let you know, folks, and tell me if I'm right about this, but if I was to describe Marmite from a taste standpoint, I would describe it as salted tar.
Yeah, see, I'm exactly right.
Is that what you say too?
I think that view is slightly influenced by what it looks like, because it does look like tar as well. But the truth with Marmite is that 50% of people love it and the other 50% hate it.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's 5% that like Vegemite, which is a whole different discussion down in Australia.
Exactly.
So I want to explore this whole idea of this social aspect, and the social norms, and when we go into the ESG, the social issues related to something. So, for example, I would say that from a social standpoint. Again, I'm loose in this area. You have this more down than I do. But from a social, I would say, Facebook is a really bad thing for society. Okay? Just the very nature of it. But that's one thing. Then there's other social ideas. It could be abortion. It could be, I guess vaping to a degree could be social to a degree. I don't think it falls in the other ones, right? Maybe not environmental, really. Maybe it's good on the environmental because it's not the carbon exhalation from cigarettes, but yet it's so. But my point is that when you're doing this, how do you come up with this idea of social norms, or maybe even the whole idea of acceptable social levels of acceptance? It seems to be this moving target that is very difficult to nail down.
It's a great question. So first of all, the key word is materiality. Cigarettes would not be relevant from an environmental perspective at all, because there's just no material impact.
Okay.
But as you rightly point out or allude to, it is subjective whether something is a big issue in society or not. I mean, a good example is the CEO, McDonald's CEO, being fired recently for a consensual relationship with an employee. Now, the company sells...
I need to stop you.
Yeah.
It seems that in that particular news headline and story and what you just said, the word consensual seems to be constantly coming up, and I find that odd. Because a non-consensual relationship would mean rape, right? So, okay, why is it, are they trying to soften it by saying the word consensual versus a relationship with, you know, I don't understand why that seems to be in the, every single time it's a modifier in this particular circumstance.
I guess, you know, to me, it's a bit surprising that he was fired. I mean, it's quite hard to decide ahead of time who you're going to fall in love with. And the fact that she was an employee doesn't really bother me personally, but that's just, that's my subjective opinion. Whereas obviously it did bother other people. Mm-hmm. And I guess my point was that they sell, as a company, a lot of sugar to children. And, you know, that's not a reason to fire the CEO, clearly, because it's like the bread and butter of the business. Mm-hmm. But it is, so our job as ESG analysts is to work out which of these social issues are going to be material. And the Me Too movement was material. Mm-hmm. So we have been looking at culture issues. And this is where governance comes back in again. If it's a board of stale, male, pale directors, and they've all been to Harvard together and they all have been on the board for 20 years, maybe we can assume that their friendship is more of a priority than instilling the best culture at the company.
Yeah, thinking Tesla as an example.
Right.
I mean, that just described, well, Tesla's handpicked board that allowed Elon to do whatever he wanted to do and create an unbelievable benefit package for himself that is just extraordinary, or a compensation package, which is extraordinary on the if he meets those numbers, right?
$2 billion, I think it's probably
fair. Oh, is that
enough.
All it was? Oh, could have been worse.
Yeah.
So it is my understanding that your belief as a company and why you do this is that you can better manage and find opportunities and avert risk to a degree, as well as be actively involved in the proxy voting process and thereby making or hoping to be involved to a point to ensure that many of the things that could be beneficial from an investor standpoint is set up correctly, right?
Couldn't have said it better.
So how does this impact? So with that in mind, we have this incredible rush and movement towards index investing, passive investing, which clearly doesn't have an ESG division that is looking at anything more so than just match and mimic a particular index. Now, those indices, that's either S&P 500, Russell, Wilshire, pick your poison what it is, may in fact have some ESG oversight or analysis going on, but I dare say that since it's not actively managed as such, you believe obviously that you have a leg up on the passive investing side, right?
True.
With the ESG, with that further overlay. So it would seem to me that either the index funds or the index concept is going to have to go and figure out a way in which to either, if this does really provide a benefit, put some of that in there, or somehow there's going to be a long-term advantage to active investing, utilizing this. Again, that's your hope, right?
Well, in some ways, we don't mind if passive investors don't do more on ESG because it gives us a relative advantage. When you engage with a company and they know you can sell the stock, it gives you more weight in terms of them listening to what you're asking for.
Yeah.
And it means that you, for some reason, the passive funds don't seem to be voting their shares particularly effectively. I mean, they're spending a lot of money on growing their proxy voting teams, but they seem to be supporting management a lot of the time. So, you know, I said the 75% vote against CEO pay for us. We've seen the biggest passive fund competitors. Their statistic there is more like 3% of against votes on CEO pay. And actually, they could change that really easily. And I'm not sure why they're not, but it does mean that it's more difficult for us to make effective changes in terms of how the market's incentivizing CEOs. But the positive feedback loop that one gets from the proxy voting process, mm-hmm. the engagements, and then the research is really an advantage for active managers, because with that three-pronged attack, you get a lot of information, and a lot of it's very useful in terms of picking stocks.
Right.
So you can take very big active weights based on the information you're getting in that process.
So it's interesting because now we're going to combine the whole idea of G, the governance, and we're going to combine the idea of index investing for a second. I did a little research and I thought maybe you would find this interesting, okay? Because you have index investors that are out there and we have companies like BlackRock, for example. I'm sure you probably know this, but I'm going to throw this out at you. Larry Fink, back in 2019, paid a total salary of a little over $26 million overall. But the previous year, his stock is actually went down about 21%. And I mean, what happened there? Where is this dislocation between the pay of a company like BlackRock, who is an index investor, and basically, you know, they are taking a piece of the action of creating these indices, and again, this dislocation between his pay and, what his stock is doing. I mean, what is in fact his pay then aligned to?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example of a pay package that's maybe not fully aligned with the shareholder experience. And I think the fact that Larry Fink seems to be very proactive on talking about sustainability. And
he's all over the place talking about this, right? No, he's on it, talking about this. I think he even, didn't he sign the business roundtable letter that talked about, you know, that companies should be focusing more on, what was it, on shareholder and stakeholders rather than exclusively on their shareholders? What was the whole thing on that?
Yeah, this is an interesting sort of philosophical point about whether companies themselves should focus mainly on the shareholders, because that's who owns the business, or whether they should focus on the wider stakeholders. And arguably, the wider stakeholders and the shareholders have the same interest. So that's why I say it's philosophical, because if you're BP and you're spilling oil in the Gulf of Mexico, it's going to almost bankrupt your business. So, you know, that's what happened in 2010 or whatever it was. And so there is already an alignment, but where I get a little bit more cynical is when a CEO who's already paid a huge amount of money and doesn't like shareholders voting against mm-hmm. that design mm-hmm. is also saying, we no longer primarily respond to shareholders. When you remove the relationship between shareholders and corporates, you actually take away a huge benefit to society, I would say. And this is, I think, probably not a very well understood thing in society, but shareholders exercise a lot of judgment when they are being stewards of a company. If a director is not giving their all to a board, then we'll vote against them. If they're too overstretched, they're on like 20 boards and they don't have enough time, we'll vote against. And Delaware company law actually relies on shareholder stewardship as a guide, because it's so clearly in the best interest of the company that it's a really objective source of opinion. But so that's why I think that actually shareholders do play a good role, and it's important that the stewardship that they have over their companies is maintained, so that pay packages like Larry Fink's are scrutinized more. I'm a little bit cynical of all the talk. And
It seems that way. I mean, it seems like you're talking about one thing and then you're getting another, but as long as he gets paid all sorts of money, everything's fine.
Right.
You know, now I got two closing questions for you. Coming from growing up and living over in England and now living in the U.S., two questions, okay? First, Guinness, warm or cold?
It's got to be cold.
Cold. Okay, so, all right. Here's the real one. You ready?
I think so.
Football or soccer?
It's got to be football.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, football? Football?
Not the U.S. one.
So it's football. You're saying, now my question was, do you prefer it? I think you heard me as, what is the proper name?
Right. It's got to be football because soccer is the American, you know, it's the American word for football.
Yeah, we try to play. We're not so good.
You're going to be better than us any minute. I think your ladies' team is the best in the world, right?
I don't know. I honestly, to be very honest with you, I've tried so many times to, I prefer curling and darts to soccer or football, whatever you call it.
That's a huge improvement on me. I'm a real failure to the male species.
Oh really? I can't. I watch it and I'm like, this is just going up and down, up and down. It's more. I prefer hockey, which is basically the same game, you know, but with a stick.
Hockey looks fun. Ice hockey looks like the only sport I would actually want to watch. To be honest,
that's a good sport, and it's cool in there. I like that. That's what I like about it. You don't have to sweat it up and all that. It's cool. You hang out. There's good food and good beer. So anyway, listen, Robbie Miles from Allianz on ESG. I really appreciate it. We'll put all the show notes information on where they can find you, more information on Allianz, more information on ESG. I think is an area that you're really going to have to focus on in the future to look at the understanding of the environmental, social, and governance factors and scoring systems that are out there when it comes to understanding more and getting a better glimpse into fundamental analysis. So I really appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
All right, we'll talk. I thought that was pretty enlightening, if nothing else, understanding a lot more about how the analysis of ESG components individually and together can actually somehow help to understand about the company's prospects for the future. I really do think you're going to be seeing a lot more about this and the blending in of these techniques, or at least these analysis points, into the fundamental analysis of a stock, of a sector, region, country. And I think it's going to become more and more important and more, I think it's going to become very much in the news and in the actual upfront analysis, because some of these things are being pushed from a variety of different social aspects. But more importantly, I think there is something to be said about looking a little bit deeper into companies, because there is a lot more information available on them. And then the historical reference on how some of these things really work to actually have a better window into what a company is doing and the prospects for the future when you look at individually companies and their governance, or what's going on with their product line and how that may be impacting the environment, and then what is the financial impact from there. So again, you can kind of take all these different components separately or put them together. A lot of interesting things to look at. But with that, we're going to end it this week early a bit than usual. I want to thank you so much for being there. Again, we'll be here next week. Meb Faber is our guest next week, and a lot of people know him. He has a great podcast out there. Make sure to listen in. It's the first time he's going to be on the show. We're going to have some great time, great discussion, and explore an incredible amount of areas with Meb. So I'll see you again next week. Thanks for joining. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida, and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.